I hope this is the right kind of talk. It's going to be a big mixture of cosmology and quantum gravity, and then back to cosmology again right at the end of the talk. What I'm going to be doing is revisiting the calculation of the production of tensor fluctuations in inflation from the point of view of quantum gravity. So I'm not going to make any ad hoc assumptions like cosmologists make or bring things in that have the taste of quantum gravity. That is not really quantum gravity. So this is actually quantum gravity in the Ashtekar formulation. So it is not quantum gravity as it is done nowadays. It is quantum gravity as it was done in 1990 or thereabouts, because I won't need any more. But what I will be doing is revisiting that calculation from that point of view of a theory which actually purports to quantize gravity completely. And the result is actually quite surprising, because there are corrections. They're actually very big. They're very dramatic. In fact, you would expect a big asymmetry between right and left gravitons in the graviton background. And it is, of course, for those who have done anything with polarization in the microwave background, of course, this would leave a massive imprint, observational imprint. Okay, so that's what I'm going to be doing. Cosmology and quantum gravity, not a happy family. The relation has not always been the smoothest one. Part of the problem is there are some really dodgy characters on both sides of the fence. Cosmologists sometimes are really embarrassingly naive. How can you believe that the scalar field is fundamental? It has to be a joke, okay? So, and there's nothing wrong with playing with scalar fields, that's okay, but obviously if you want to make any contact with our cousins doing fundamental physics, you have to go beyond that. And on the other side of the fence, I don't know if you've come across that. So quantum gravity sometimes, present company excluded, obviously, but sometimes you find this impression that some people think it's in bad taste to make contact with observations in quantum gravity. Some people are too mathematically oriented. And this is really quite silly, because if you think a bit about it, a marriage, if not of love, at least of convenience, is highly advisable, because it's very unlikely that you're going to test quantum gravity in any other way. It's possible, and you can think or can dream of ways in which you do it, but in principle, it's the early universe that's going to be the testing bed for quantum gravity. But even theoretically, I think bringing the two things together is very helpful. And you're going to see that actually cosmology can bring focus to quantum gravity calculations. You'll see quite respectable people, some of which present here. I think if you guys had just sat down and tried to rederive cosmological perturbation theory, quite a lot of mistakes could have been avoided, or misunderstandings, or whatever. But reciprocally, this works in both directions. Reciprocally, the calculation of fluctuations done in cosmology is really, really dodgy as well. And you probably need quantum gravity to actually put things on a safe ground. So this is kind of the worries you might have in mind in cosmology. If you look at the scales of the universe you observe nowadays, it starts smaller than Planck. There's a trans-Planckian menace. How do you deal with that? These things tend to be vacuum fluctuations. You really know what a vacuum state is. And then, in addition, there's this perception that inflation is insulated from quantum gravity. Well, how can you make a statement like this if you don't know what quantum gravity theory is? So this is merely a dogma, probably, at best wishful thinking. You need to reassess all these assumptions from the point of view of quantum gravity. Say it again?
That's not limited to inflation.
No, it's all of us. Mea culpa, everyone is blamed to be blamed for it. I agree with you completely. So in fact, given I'm going to be talking about inflation, that's the target. So it's a moment of historical reflection. Actually, I gave this talk in McGill. You know, Robert was right there at the start. It's actually quite curious. When inflation was first proposed, it was never meant to stand alone. So the idea was that there's a lot of holes, initial state, various things, which were meant to be filled in, all these gaps were meant to be filled in by quantum cosmology. And then what actually happened throughout the 80s is that the ADM canonical quantization program failed to deliver the goods, and inflation was left to fend for itself. And you guys in quantum gravity, you picked up the little project, never actually came to the rescue. So I think historically, in a way, although I'm going to go back to quantum gravity in the 90s, that's when the big schism developed, and I think it's really bad. So as I said, I've actually given this talk cosmologists and quantum gravity people equal numbers of times. The first thing I try to do is give you a background for both sides, and then, okay, this is quantum gravity for cosmologists. Most of you, there's a few cosmologists I can notice. You can see here. So shall I go slowly? So for cosmologists, this is a quarter of an hour. For quantum gravity, it is 2 minutes.
What does that mean about quantum gravity? Well, I don't need any of your fancy stuff. Thank you very much. Okay, so let me just kind of summarize this. Basically, the Ashteca formalism is nothing but an elaboration of something called the Palatini formulation of GDR. So I say Palatini Kibble, because if you say Kibble, the cosmologists wake up immediately. And in fact, Tom Kibble did quite a lot of work on this. It's basically a formulation of GR which looks like a gauge theory. And the crucial idea is that you make the connection the central object, because that's a gauge field. And of course, to do that, what you do is you relegate the metric to the status of the sidekick, in a way, when you quantize. But crucially, in the classical theory, you say that the two things, metric and connection, are a priori independent variables. And then one field equation will, in the end, actually enforce the connection to be the Christoffel connection if there are no spinners, if there's no torsion. But that comes later on as a field equation. It's not built into the formalism. So there's no master-slave relation, so the usual second-order Einstein-Hilbert formalism, the metric is the master, the connection is the slave. Well, here they're independent, and in fact, you give priority to the connection because that's your gauge field. Okay, so that's basically what this tetrad and these connection forms mean. What the Ashteca formalism does is basically you take the action, which represents gravity, which is the Palatini action, and you add to it the surface term. So this looks a bit innocuous. You know, why the hell am I doing this? This is very similar to having like an e square minus b square, and then an a d dot b term with like a theta parameter, like in QCD. Okay? And in fact, the thing which plays that role here is the gamma parameter, which is called the Meusy parameter. And it just so happens, some people don't know what the Ashteca variables are. Well, it's basically the self-dual and the anti-self-dual bits of the connection. It turns out when the gamma is plus or minus I, the action becomes just a function of the self-dual connection or the anti-self-dual connection. So the gamma can be, in this formulation, can be complex. Indeed, it should be complex. It should be this, if you want the self-dual formulation. And this means you complexify the theory. This is very important. You actually allow the metric to be complex to begin with, and the connection to be complex. And it's only later on, down the line when you quantize it, you impose something called the reality conditions, which brings you down to the theory as you see it. Okay, so you might say, so what? That's what cosmologists say. Fair enough. Well, so nothing classically. But as you know, quantum mechanically, you can use the QCD example, the analogy. Quantum mechanically, the story is very different, and people have indeed explored instanton effects, parity violating instanton effects, because of this extra term. So what I'm going to be talking about has nothing to do with this. It's actually a completely perturbative result. But you can immediately see that there's going to be something new when you quantize the theory, which depends on the Meusy parameter. Okay. Everyone with me? Even the quantum gravity guy? So. Okay, good. Another way to look at it, which is going to be closer, what I have to say, is if you have, for example, the standard Palatini formulation in the Hamiltonian framework, in a canonical framework, all you're doing is a canonical transformation. So basically, instead of using your extrinsic curvature, you actually use something which is transformed. You add little bits with which are the connection, the Christoffel connection of your spatial metrics, and you basically, it doesn't really matter how much you add because they commute with the ease, and you preserve the canonical structure. When you do this, so what? Classically, so nothing, but quantum mechanically, so everything. And one thing you can see immediately is that, of course, you can now, with a formulation like this, it is really, really similar to a gauge theory. This is your electric field. This is your gauge field. Okay? And you can basically now hope to import things like Fermi-Young-Mills theories, like Wilson loops and so on, to do the quantization in gravity. This becomes a commutator.
This is a Poisson bracket.
This is a Poisson bracket. So this is classically what happens quantum mechanically. Mm-hmm. Yeah, then you have to find ways of representing these operators. And this is where the whole business starts, and then it becomes commutators.
So what is capital E there?
It's it's actually the densitized inverse trial. Mm. It's the canonical conjugate of this connection. And it looks like an electric field.
Okay.
So in something like, in fact, what people do eventually is represent the A's by the holonomies of the connection and these by the fluxes of these fields. Okay, why did I can start thinking about this? There's a paper by these two guys there. Okay, I'm going to be insulting them and praising them and insulting them and praising them. Yeah. Actually, a few years ago, they wrote a paper saying that the Kodama state, or fluctuations around the Kodama state, should be seen as the gravitons in the Sitter space-time. So I thought, well, we have all these issues in inflation, we don't know how to answer. And why not use these? This is basically the wave function of the universe. But like not in the ADM formalism, which was driven by the metric, but driven by the connection. So this looked like a perfect thing for saying, is the wave function of the universe during inflation? Let's kind of see what this has to say about the transplanting problem, the vacuum state, blah, 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 blah. And actually, that's the reason why I found this so interesting initially. And I realize that this has become very, very, very old-fashioned. People nowadays do spin foams and everything and blah, blah, blah. This is 1990, basically, the Kodama state and so on. So this is my mentor in the field, and quite unethically here. And I'm being filmed, I think, and recorded, but quite unethically. This is a private communication in which it was said that some recent developments in quantum gravity are just sweeping the problems under the carpet. I don't know if you agree with this. You agree with this? No. Okay, good. So going back to, but see, actually, I'm even going to go back before loops. I'm not going to be using loops. I'm going to be using the connection completely. Okay. Silence.
It's tragic. Just to say the name.
Are you going to tell us what is special about Kodama state? Or?
Yes, I'm going to explain everything about Kodama state, why it doesn't work, why it's completely useless nonsense, why these guys got it all wrong and everything. But the motivation was this work. It would be great if it worked, but it doesn't. But at least it would be good to understand why it doesn't work. Okay, so this is the bit for. Well, this is a bit about quantum gravity for cosmologists. Now, let me tell you a bit about the cosmology side of the story for quantum gravity people. So very, very simply, what cosmologists do is perturbation theory. We don't know how to do anything else except perturbing a Friedman universe. And it just turns out you take a Friedman universe, you shake it a little bit, and group theory just tells you that you can classify the fluctuations into scalars, vectors, and tensors. These guys are density fluctuations or gradient flows, which represent, for example, galaxies. That the most underrated kind of fluctuations, they represent vorticity. What I'm going to be talking about in this talk is the tensor modes, which is gravity waves. And specifically, I'm going to model inflation in the most basic way, I don't want complications with inflatons. I'm going to consider tensor modes around the Sitter. So if you want to be geometrical, I take a section of the Sitter in a flat slicing. That's what cosmologists use. We can use it because eventually it decays into a Friedman universe. And then you consider fluctuations which are purely spatial and transverse and traceless, by means of which you solve the Gauss constraint and the Diffie-Morphism. So very important here is these kind of things because people in gravity, quantum gravity don't know. If you do something like this, the conformal time is negative, obvious for cosmologists, and grows to zero. This is going to be very important later on. And then what you do is you plug this inside the Einstein equations, you shake it, and you see what happens. And eventually, if you want to translate this into cosmology speak, you introduce this variable called V, which everyone basically, when you do this, everyone understands what you're doing, cosmology, and this is what you obtain. So what you obtain is an equation of a harmonic oscillator with a mass term which is time dependent and which is negative. So I've seen very respectable people, the present company included, okay, going completely crazy. Oh, we have a ghost in the theory. Something went wrong, blah, blah, blah. Well, this is actually linearization around some state. So, of course, you have an instability. There's nothing wrong with having a ghost in the theory, which is a perturbative theory. And there's even nothing wrong with saying this is our vacuum or our base state. It just means there is an instability. In fact, there is an instability. It's, even as a name, it's called the Jeans instability. Or the gravitational instability. If we did not have this ghost, in the theory, we would not be here. This will all be homogeneous and isotropic.
Well, it's a negative mass.
So
usually people call that vacuum.
What? Okay.
The cost is more
kinetic terms, kinetic.
Yeah.
I'm just making comments to Finn.
Okay, anyway.
No, it's hard to offend.
Is it? I know, I'm trying. I'll do my best.
So what actually happens is the following. Whenever this guy dominates, you just have, maybe I should show this, you have region 1 and region 2. When term 1 dominates, you just have an harmonic oscillator. So you say you're inside your horizon, microphysics dominates. When term 2 dominates, you say you left your horizon. And you have the gravitational instability making your modes grow. So you say that you solve the horizon problem in inflation because it is negative and grows to 0. So this guy is initially very negative, so this is very small. So you actually start inside the horizon, and then you leave the horizon. You take a Friedman universe, it's exactly the opposite. Okay, so what do cosmologists do? They do something really unsavory. They solve these using second quantization. They basically take this regime when things are inside the horizon. They're obviously just harmonic oscillators. They normalize them like this in the knowledge that if you put an amplitude here, and now you second quantize, which means you put hats over everything, then these guys become under canonical quantization. These guys become creation and annihilation operators. And now a big miracle happens in the sitter. This is the cool thing. This doesn't happen in any other case. In the sitter, when you solve the whole thing, this guy appears multiplied by this guy here, this function here. So when you compute the vacuum expectation value of this guy, I'm going to be repeating this calculation later. You have like a number operator, some normal ordering thing, which gives you a constant. So basically, all you get is V squared for the vacuum expectation value. And it turns out that fluctuations, which start off like 1 over k inside the horizon, with the Jeans instability in the sitter, grow to be 1 over k cubed outside the horizon, which means scaling invariant. So this is the miracle of the sitter. This does not happen with any other model. You actually end up with fluctuations outside the horizon, which are scaling variant. Okay, very dodgy. As I said, what is the vacuum? Do I know what I'm doing? Do I know what I'm talking about? Probably not. But basically, the main question is, with second quantizing metric fluctuations without the full knowledge of quantum gravity, is this really correct? And basically, there is this big issue. If I were to do this from the point of view of something that purports to be a full theory of quantum gravity, would I really not get any correction to this procedure? So my talk is exactly about that. You know, the punchline, the answer is no. Actually, the quantum theory matters. The full quantum theory matters. Indeed, the Emirzi parameter appears. That's a shocking thing. You find that although the spectrum of gravitons is the same for right and left gravitons, we'll talk about that, the vacuum fluctuations are not, depending on the Emirzi parameter. And for example, if you take the very extreme case of the self-dual connection, which is gamma equals I, you end up with the same calculation, exactly the same calculation with scaling invariant fluctuations, but you only have left-handed gravitons left outside the horizon, which is quite shocking. And then by dialing the Emirzi parameter, you can have more or less chirality. But basically, quantum gravity does matter. And if you're a cosmologist, you can go to sleep, because what's going to happen in the next, I don't know, what time is it? Maybe half an hour. It's going to be technical details. I hope for you guys to throw tomatoes at me, you know, and so on, because it's going to be a technical issue. Towards the end of the talk, what I'm going to do is go back and explain why this matters observationally in a very dramatic way in cosmology.
I'm going to tell you what's wrong with this before I hear what it is. because probably after what.
So if it's wrong, it's just going wrong, and I need to continue the talk.
No, but I mean, so it's just like freshman quantum mechanics or whatever. The first quantum mechanics, they tell you that at the quadratic level, as long as you have a quadratic Hamiltonian, you can just take the classical Hamiltonian and quantize it, and there is no ambiguity. At the higher level, there might be ambiguities because you don't know how to commute.
And what I'm going to show is that your Hamiltonian is qubit. It's the first one. When you try to find the perturbation theory, you have all kinds of ordering issues that you wouldn't find otherwise. And you have twice as many, actually four times as many variables.
But you are quantizing free gravitons, aren't you?
Yes, and the free gravitons are going to be quite dramatically different in this architectural form.
So this is different from any other free theory that you quantize.
This is a theory. You've got to see, the question is the following. What is the gravity? In a theory that's symmetric in the connection, you have a Heisenberg relation. Is it metric? Is it connection? It's going to be a funny combination of the two.
Yeah.
Which is kind of, that's the crucial point. Mm-hmm. So when you try to actually represent these in your form, like as a quadratic thing, you get the kind of things that you wouldn't initially expect to get. Mm-hmm. To do with the ordering issues as well. So this goes back to the ordering of the, for example, the Hamiltonian constraint.
Yeah.
And other, you know, other ordering issues.
So you think there is an ordering issue in, because, I mean,
but for gravity, oh god, there is a huge one. And in fact, what I'm going to argue then is that usually, what do you think about ordering issues? If you quantization, if you quantization, it just means you have not quantized gravity properly. If you had done it properly mathematically, there would be any ambiguities about ordering. But to my mind, ordering is a problem with quantum mechanics, not with quantum gravity.
But that never comes in at the quadratic level. It always comes in at the level.
It can come at the quadratic level.
So that's the thing that's surprised. So
you can actually do crazy things with p squared. You can put like exponential of x, p, and an exponential minus x, and then p. You can do all kinds of crazy
things. That's not quadratic.
No, of course not. Okay. But something which usually classically is quadratic could quantum mechanically be something quite crazy.
Yeah, but then those would be suppressed by the coupling constant.
So everyone says that you wouldn't see these effects here because the energy scale of inflation is lower than Planck. Actually, I think it has nothing to do with the procedure of quantization. Forget about the energy scale. And what I'm going to argue is that the second quantization procedure is completely crap. Okay? What you should be doing is driving it.
But you understand why I'm skeptical, because good.
So I think the crucial point is, if you want an intuitive way to look at it, is this Heisenberg principle between metric and connection. In fact, that basically they're related by a field equation, classically. But that means torsion being zero. What you are allowing is a torsion to fluctuate and mechanic. Mm-hmm. And that gives you a theory, the second quantized level, which is different.
Okay.
But bear with me, okay, sure. And then see if you still disagree with me. If you still disagree with me, continue. Okay, so what follows now is going to be a lot of technical details. And so first of all, it's actually not easy to recover the cosmological perturbation theory cosmologists know and love from the Ashtekar formalism. And it's an exercise you have to do, and you have to get it right, because otherwise, when you quantize, everything is wrong. If the classical theory is wrong, of course, the quantum theory is wrong as well. And this is a non-trivial exercise, and you probably have noticed this. When you do perturbation theory, either you perturb the Einstein equations or you perturb the action. You never actually find a canonical formulation. And the reason is it's extremely awkward to actually do this. It has been done in the second order formalism in 1994. This is a very underrated paper. No one actually knows about this. It's a nightmare. This is the reason why no one actually does it. And it's even worse in the Ashtekar formalism, because it really is not designed for perturbative work. It's designed for non-perturbative work. But it's an important check. What comes out of these are technical things. So you guys wake up. This is serious. You basically find that a lot of, let's call this misunderstandings, because maybe it's just notation, maybe it's more than that. But so very often people found things like reality conditions constraining graviton states moving in opposite directions. That cannot possibly be true. If you look at the Hamiltonians people wrote, they were pump terms, coupling K and minus K inside the horizon. These terms do exist as you leave the horizon. They're called particle production terms as you leave the horizon, but inside the horizon they have to be zero. I think one big problem is that there's this belief that the helicity states align with duality states. So the self-dual connection is the right graviton. It's not, and you'll see why. And very closely related to this, the idea that the Kodama state can be used as the base state for quantum gravity, it doesn't work exactly because helicity states are not graviton. Okay, so these are the technical things I'm going to be debunking for the next 5-10 minutes, but basically these are the issues. So as I said, there's one thing cosmologists know how to do, and that's perturbation theory, and they don't count to anything else, but anyway, that they can do. So in this case, take these two variables, so find the zero order, and then perturb, and put factors of A with the benefit of hindsight, which will make this variable the V variable of cosmologists. Okay, very important, when you expand this in Fourier series, which is what we all do, do not forget the negative frequencies. So I finally understood, I was in Penn State, I finally understood why people threw away the negative frequencies, because there's actually an isomorphism telling you that the full Hilbert space can be derived from the positive frequencies. Is that right?
Well, forget the isomorphisms, just do the calculation, right? Okay, it's very important to have the negative frequencies there, otherwise you basically forget half the modes and you end up with a lot of trouble. In addition, your theory is actually complex to begin with, and the reality conditions are going to be essential for exactly creating novelties. And the reality conditions basically tell you that the positive and negative frequencies should be independent. Okay? So very important technical point.
It's complex. So what is supposed to be real then?
Well, we'll get there. That is one of the main... All the novelties are going to derive from that, actually. So the actual, well, in fact, the angle triangle is zero, sure. But off shell, it is complex.
Off shell is complex. I'm just saying, so is this a Hermitian Hamiltonian?
It is a Hermitian with an inner product, which I want to define, which is not the obvious one, but it's complex. So don't confuse the two things. Because with a trivial inner product, if something is complex, not Hermitian, in this case it is.
So what is the meaning of reality condition? What is supposed to be real?
It's the thing, I'll tell you a bit. Okay. Basically, it tells you, it will have to tell you at the quantum level that you don't have an anti-gravity, you only have a gravity. Okay. But you have to start with both kinds of particles. Okay, a third technical point is that...
Okay, then I understood finally why people did these matters. Okay, so... First of all, people are in love with the Neumann-Penrose tetrad, which I think is really, really confusing. Second, because of the Hamiltonian formulation, there was this understanding you could throw away the time component of the amplitude, and then define amplitude, and define ellipticities in this way. This is going to confuse the physics completely. Until you know the direction of propagation of a mode, you don't know what's right, what's left. Okay? So these are very simple physical points, not very nice. This is the expansion I'm advocating. So the R here is ellipticity, so it's right, left. And now what I'm saying is that you must have positive and negative frequencies. Very important here in this time function, consider, if you don't like the time function, consider the Hamiltonian formulation, but with an initial condition with the right time derivative. It's important that the mode is moving in the direction k, not minus k. Okay? So it's important to have the right boundary condition here so that k really labels the direction of propagation. Otherwise, these guys mean absolutely nothing physically. And then it's important as well that the negative frequencies are just the complex conjugates of this guy, but in the amplitudes I need another index. So I have a right left for ellipticity, and I must have a plus minus for graviton, antigraviton when I begin with. And in addition, I must have amplitudes for metric and for the connection. So a hell of a mess for cosmologists, okay? We basically work, for each K, we have two modes, right and left. You actually have eight modes in the Ashteka formula. So it's two, so it's right left, graviton, antigraviton, and then metric and connection. And then eventually the whole thing is going to reduce to the right, you know, hopefully with some kind of difference, it's going to reduce to the right so number of degrees of freedom, but only later on. Technical point, any problems with this? You lose the sleep, excellent, okay. This is why you always get things wrong, you never listen to this. Okay, good. So there you are, reality conditions. Okay, so instead of having reality conditions coupling K and minus K like this guy was asleep, okay, now. What you actually get is, if you actually do this in these expansions, you only get that the graviton and the antigraviton are the same. So if you actually impose the condition that the metric is real, this is what you get. And then you get these torsion-free conditions as well. So your A's and E's must be related with these expressions. So quite different reality conditions with respect to what people had done before. I'm being technical, but this is important. Okay, another technical point, if you actually were to solve for these functions here and actually work out what happens, just using the Lagrange equations for these various components, for the case of the self-dual anti-self-dual connection, you don't get gravitons. This was actually known since 1986 and then was forgotten completely. The self-dual connection contains the right positive frequency of the graviton and the left negative frequency of the antigravity. So it's basically like a skewed thing. You don't get an alignment between graviton and ellipticity states and duality states. Okay, very important point. This is why the Kodama state could never work, and we'll see this later on. Self-dual states are really half of one graviton and half of the other graviton. So half of the right one and half of the left one.
Okay, so as I said, we have to recover the cosmological perturbation theory out of these. Despite everyone says blah, 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 this has all been done before. Well, it hasn't been done before. Is it an exercise for the student? Yes, but for a very good student. So exercise for you guys. Take the Hamiltonian constraint, plug everything inside all these expansions and see what comes out. And you find to your horror that you don't actually get the Hamiltonian cosmologies to use. So I was very shocked by this. This was my reaction. My God, this is completely, this is a really disaster. What is wrong? And in fact, what is wrong is that there's a bunch of details which we don't have to deal with in, for example, explaining the action, which are very important here. So very important, just some technical points, but the boundary term is very important. More to the point, there's this belief, and loop quantum cosmology people do exactly the same, there's this belief that when you expand your variables, what you're doing is you're freezing, and then you quantize, you're freezing the background, and then you let the fluctuations be quantum. It's actually not at all. What you're doing is a canonical transformation between two pairs of variables, which happen to be small. The new ones happen to be small in some cases. Why is this relevant? It's actually a time-dependent canonical transformation. And if you just plug the expansion inside the Hamiltonian, you get the wrong result. You need to add the time derivative of the generating function. Okay, a bunch of technical things, and basically, the paper you guys wrote is full of terms that don't exist, that are canceled by these. And you don't actually get... Are you pointing at each other's fingers now? It is very important. This is actually what you get in the end after your students work on this. This is actually very complicated for a general gamma, case gamma equals plus or minus I. This is eventually the Hamiltonian you obtain second order, dependent only on first order variables. And this is what you get, and indeed, your Hamilton equations derived from this Hamiltonian when combined give you the equation we all know about. Okay, but you have to sweat, basically. So you do get the thing in the end, and you'd better quantize the right thing, but you have to sweat a lot and massage the theory a lot before you get there. Okay, so it all goes through except for one thing. So this is the last thing I have to say about the classical theory, and then let's get on with the quantum one. Hamiltonian constraint is the only thing that doesn't apply in the perturbation theory. I think this is actually quite cool. So at some point in Imperial College, we had like 7 Greek students all working on the problem of time and quantum mechanics and quantum gravity and all this thing. And so this is my take on it. It's actually something you find a lot in, if you've done perturbation theory a la cosmologist, you see this kind of Russian doll thing in which if you look at cubic terms, you have like quadratic times linear, 3 linear ones, you have all these combinations coming in. So if the Hamiltonian is to be zero on shell, it has to be zero first order, second order, third order, etc. But the second order Hamiltonian is made of the thing I just showed you before, which is quadratic terms in the linear variables, and things which are linear in the second order variables. Back reaction, okay? You're worried about this, obviously. So it's the whole thing, it has to be zero. In other words, what you actually look at in cosmology, when you look at fluctuations, does not satisfy a Hamiltonian constraint. So here's my take on the problem, my Canadian 50-cent contribution to the problem of time in quantum gravity. Well, maybe there is a problem, but, you know, basically time is an illusion of perturbation theory. But don't knock it, because we live obviously in a perturbative scenario. So you never look at the back reaction, you look at the linear variables, and those don't satisfy the Hamiltonian constraint, and therefore there is a time. So if you want to be provocative, you could also say that the problem of time is an illusion of non-perturbative theory, okay? You should be putting the thing around. But of course, it's kind of being a bit philosophical. Okay, I'm gonna move on finally to what actually is new. So this is when you quantize things. Basically, you have this Poisson bracket. These things then become commutators for these variables. What is the crucial difference here? Okay, this probably will address your question. The crucial thing here is that you have a kind of Heisenberg relation between your connection and your metric variables. And then the question is, what is the graviton? Okay, so in this framework, there's many ways to do this, but if you restrict yourself to the self-dual connection, one way to do this is just put all these expansions inside the Hamiltonian and see what comes out. And you can actually see what has the role of G dagger G, okay? And you find that there's this, basically these graviton operators, which you have kind of a chiral description. Sometimes the connection, sometimes the mixtures of connections and metrics. It's just, this is what comes out of the theory. So it's really a quadratic theory, but it's in a funny kind of formulation. I don't know if you're...
Okay. I was just wondering,
So it is a quadratic Hamiltonian, but with a funny thing. And
so what is KR?
No, what do you mean? Oh, here. So the K at the most, the R is the least. So right, one for right. Which is, I said, is a kind of description
of the gravity. Now, what actually happens is that, of course, these are the commutation relations, and these guys acquire commutation relations as well. And they acquire the right commutation relations for being creation and annihilation operators for half of the modes. So this is quite funny. If you actually, for example, the self-dual connection, gamma is I, this is positive, you find that the modes that don't exist classically, so self-dual connection, right graviton, left antigraviton, so those guys have actually the right commutation relations for this to be creation and annihilation operators. The guys that don't exist classically, quantum mechanically exist, and have the wrong behavior, they basically have negative energies. You actually have a minus sign in there. Now, the cool thing is that once you identify the inner product, actually they turn out to be non-physical because they're not normalizable. And this is exactly why this is so cool. Basically, the way this is done usually is using this thing called the Bargmann representation. And now exactly this issue, what you do with the reality conditions. So there's a very important thing, the second-class constraints. So you can't just implement them the way you usually implement constraints. And the way people implement them usually is by a definition of the inner product. And this is quite an I found this very ugly when I first started, but it's actually quite a cool thing. And basically, in the end, what it does, it rules out things, the extra modes you don't like. So there's too many particles in the theory. Why? Because the theory is complex. But then your reality conditions are implemented via the inner product, and the inner product tells you these states are not normalizable, and you throw them away. Because you say you have a space which is too big. So the cool thing is that actually, if you look at these reality conditions, and if you look at the G's I wrote, these guys here, you find that basically saying, initially, there's no, this is just a creation operator and an annihilation operator. What I'm saying now is that I want actually my creation operator to be the dagger of my annihilation operator. I didn't know what this was until I defined the inner product, and it turns out that this is exactly what I need to do to implement the reality conditions. So this is like stand-up. This is what you do. You do some integration by parts, and you end up with an inner product which is non-trivial. And there you are. This is the factor which turns in there, which basically makes your particle states for the modes you don't like non-normalizable. So negative norms or infinite norms, all kinds of things. So this is a familiar story. You work with a larger space of states. Some are pathological, but then they don't belong to the physical subspace. And you end up in the end with this Hamiltonian, okay, quadratic. What's special about this?
So remember at some point later,
about here, so suppose there is an asymmetry in the description. The asymmetry is that, for example, the right annihilation operator, so the right mode, the right physical mode is the right graviton. This guy is just a connection. But this guy here for the left, so the left minus, which is the physical one for the self-dual connection, contains the metric and the connection. So if I have an ordering prescription in which I put all the E's to the side of the A's, which is absolutely crucial in quantum gravity, this is actually what happens. Although the states have the same spectrum, the vacuum energy is chiral. So only one of these guys appears in need of to be normal order, not the other. So nothing is different, in fact. So this is the twist. So it's a familiar story, but with a twist. And the twist is that only one of the gravitons needs to be normal order. This goes back to the ordering prescription you used. And what turns out from all of this is that, you know, you could actually find an ordering prescription which erases the effect. You can actually consider the anti-self-dual connection and you have the opposite effect. So the music parameter is going to matter, but you do have a chiral vacuum. In this case, the vacuum energy, but also the two-point function for the same reasons. If you choose some kind of ordering of your modes, your A of K modes, for example, a dagger A, what actually happens is that the right guy is just an annihilation operator, the left guy is a creation operator. So once you do the calculation of the two-point function, only one of them is going to appear with a non-zero two-point function. So in the extreme case of the self-dual connection, it's only the left graviton, which has a vacuum energy and a vacuum.
What does normal ordering do? Because just changes the Hamiltonian by constant, which changes the order.
Yeah, so you're talking about the vacuums. In this case, you're talking about the vacuum energy.
Yeah.
And then the vacuum fluctuations.
So that only changes the back, affects the background, not the spectrum of fluctuations, right?
No. That's the point. It only changes the vacuum properties, not the actual particles that you can build them on.
Yeah.
So if you put a 1 there, then of course, you get a different result. The energy of a 1 particle state is the same for whatever length.
That's right. But isn't that what you're talking about?
No, but later on what I need is this, for example. Here, if I put the vacuum there, I get a different result for right and left. So your cosmological constant problem is chiral, if you want here. That's irrelevant, actually. What is more relevant is that the same thing happens with the two-point function.
Okay, so there's something I'm missing here. I'm not sure. So if it's just a constant C number, if you're changing Hamiltonian by a C number, because ordering just changes Hamiltonian by a C number, it doesn't affect any expectation value.
Well, as you can see, it does.
Okay, so it's something more than ordering, it seems to be honest.
It's just a very different, I mean, I don't know. When people have suggested this is because you're violating CPT.
So in the original action, did you violate CPT?
Well, the original actually is complex, right? So you have this issue, this is a remission. With this new product, if you actually write, these guys are remission.
But if gamma was zero, or infinity, I guess, the original action wasn't complex. So.
That's true.
Right. So where is gamma here, I guess?
Okay, well, this is Gamma's plus or minus I. I'm going to show you.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So this is the extreme thing. Mm-hmm. Actually, let me show you.
Before you go ahead, back up to where you were.
Sorry?
Just one back. The effect is erased with EFE or the emission combination?
Yeah. And this can go back to the discussion of CPT. You can find orderings for which CPT is not violated. I hear.
Now, who cares about gravitational CPT being violated? All these theorems are about. Do you care about that? Well, the energy is already non-positive because of that mass term anyway, so I wouldn't... Yeah, it could be because of the gravity. Yeah. Right. It can be negative. So if the modulus of gamma is bigger than 1, it is actually negative.
Let me just show you actually... Can I just go on and
But maybe not everybody knows the Hamiltonian constraint in the Ashtakar variables has two terms, and one of the terms is classically is EEF totally contracted. He's discussing how you order that term.
Right.
And this is what you think it would be from electromagnetism or Yang-Mills theory, because the electric field times the electric field times the magnetic field. With all the indices contracted up.
So I think I've found equal number of papers supporting east to the left and east to the right of it. What's the taste at perimeter these days?
I don't think that these days it's thought about that way.
How do you think about it? Did you sleep it on the carpet?
Well, it's an interesting question how these ordering issues come out in the choices of informal amplitudes.
Right.
Which is related to how the emergency parameter is coded into
the... Actually, there is something, too. I understand for spin foams, gamma must be real.
I will defer to the experts here.
Where are the experts here? Okay, no one is an expert. No. You are an expert. Must gamma be real for a spin foam?
So far, the models that you put out in the Lorentzian case, yes.
Is it because you don't like us?
No, it's just because this is what people can do. There's nothing fundamental.
It's just difficult to do it.
Wherever the techniques used to construct the model works only in that case. There's nothing, fundamental. Because then things become complex and representation theory becomes.
So is it because SL2C is not?
Because then SL2C is not compact.
It's not nice.
You don't control. So But this is a matter of convergence.
But that's more, that's a problem with the signature of the spacetime, isn't it?
No, that the signature of the spacetime is taken care of if gamma is
real.
So it's a matter of, let's say, you can say convenience in that sense. We don't know how to deal with the self-dual case.
Okay, let me just continue because this actually might be
really interesting to do.
So anyway, the implication, the rest of the calculation in inflation goes through exactly the same way because the functions themselves and the classical evolution is the same. So it's just the initial condition, the two-point function, which are different inside the horizon. So of course, basically, you still have a scaling invariant spectrum, but with different amplitudes. And what is interesting is you can do the calculation for other values of the emergency parameter. It's a complete mess. So what I just showed you about identifying gravitons and all this story about orderings and everything becomes much more intricate, but we've done it. And there still are two modes which are physical and which are non-physical. There still are twice as many modes than you guys use, but then you disqualify half of the modes. And the only imprint you end up in the end, when you think which is different, is this chirality in the vacuum energy and in the two-point function, which depends on the emergency parameter. And this is what you get if the emergency parameter is complex, is real, is imaginary. If it is actually generally, okay, it's the same thing I just said. The interesting thing, if you actually do this for a general complex emergency parameter, you find that there's no chirality if gamma is real. So this seems to be a specific effect associated with an imaginary emergency parameter with the complex view. In this, so if gamma is real, this is zero. In other, well, this is just for a gamma. This is for a gamma imaginary. If the gamma, you can generalize these expressions. So in fact, this is what this is. It's a generalization of this expression with the gamma real and the gamma imaginary. If you go through here, you actually find it's zero. There's no chirality at all. So the effect I'm describing is unique to an imaginary or a complex in music, right? Whatever this means. Okay.
Predict if the action, if you wrote the action just in terms of the metric perturbations, not in terms of the connection, if you had, you know, the action for the right-handed graviton was h squared times one constant, and the action for the left-handed gravitons was h sub left squared, you know, partial h sub left squared times a different constant. Were those two constants out front were different? Is that what we're talking about?
No.
One of those.
No? That's what we did first, actually. So our initial paper was a phenomenological paper in which we took some quite model which had that property exactly. It's not that. So what he says is effectively just, in fact, the theory, no, if you look at the gravitons, if you look at the Newton's constant, if you look at, for example, the quadrupole formula, none of that appears. It's just about vacuum fluctuations. That's the only thing which is different.
Right. So, I mean, in other words, the thing I was saying was their classical equations would be unchanged. They would both just be the normal.
Yeah. That's right.
Graviton equations of motion. But if you have different constants in front, then you'll get the difference.
So what you're saying is something we consider initially, which would actually have a classical effect.
No. I think. But Latham is saying it's correct. The point is that classically, the theory is general relativity is chirally symmetric.
Right.
With the choice of ordering that he's used, and with a non-real inertia parameter, the amplitude of the left-handed tensor modes is not the same as the amplitude of the right-handed tensor modes. In the vacuum fluctuations, they propagate as general relativity would propagate them, but the amplitudes from the vacuum fluctuations are different.
Right.
And that's the only difference.
So the equation of motion are the same as yours, but the initial condition is different. That doesn't show up. It is part of the action or it
isn't? Sorry, say again?
So what I'm confused is that in the action, the right and left, they both have the same form, or?
Well, I showed you, well, the action, bring back to the action is a thing. The Hamiltonian, you can see that the problem is just a quantum problem, it's an ordering issue, right? And it's just basically computing two-point functions and computing the quantum Hamiltonian that disappears.
At the end of the day, when you write the equation of motion, they both have the same equation of motion.
As it had to be. So one of the things we actually had to do is to show that classically you get the same equations.
So,
Now we did, I hope you were asking a different question, which is, you can consider theoretical, you can consider, we can conjecture the existence or otherwise, or classical theories in which the coupling would be different for right and left. And this would actually have interesting phenomenological effects, because you say you have a quadrupole that radiates gravitons, could be different for right and left gravity. But that's a classical effect. Hello everyone. So, okay, I'm obviously going. How long have I got? You told me I had like 3 hours or something ridiculous.
Okay,
10
minutes is enough. Now people have been interrupting me. Interrupt more than I have an excuse.
Okay, so much for inflation being blind to quantum gravity. That's the first thing. You just reanalyze the calculation from the point of view of a theory of quantum gravity, and you get different results. And also, so much for the Bunch-Davis vacuum being the self-evident God's choice. I mean, because obviously this is not the Bunch-Davis vacuum. So I'm going to finish just with some kind of... Of course not. The Bunch-Davis vacuum is Cairo, so it can't be the Bunch-Davis vacuum.
The Bunch-Davis vacuum doesn't cause it. It's the same
thing. So this Kodama state is what you're using as a...
It's not the Kodama
state. Okay, so I'm going to finish 10 minutes, 5 minutes for theoretical.
So what is
equation,
the
minutes for...
What is the vacuum that you use then?
Okay, so what is the vacuum? Very quick. So first of all, it's not the Kodama state. Okay, very important thing. We have identified the vacuum state for a theory which contains gravitons. It's not the Bunch-Davis vacuum, but it's chiral. Could it be the Kodama state? Answer, no. And this should be completely obvious from everything I said. In fact, we haven't published this yet, but we can actually write our vacuum. So in the Bargmann representation, the vacuum is 1, and the particle states are monomials. But you can actually write that in a more physically understandable way in terms of the connection and compare with the Kodama state and see they're not. But I don't need that to see that the Kodama state doesn't work. What is the Kodama state? Kodama state is this thing which solves the self-dual equation in the connection representation. So you diagonalize the connection, you represent your inverse triads this way, blah, blah, blah. And then it just so happens if you order the Hamiltonian EES, obviously if you solve the self-dual equation, you solve the Hamiltonian constraint. Okay? Very nice, very simple. It should be completely obvious. If you have ever done perturbation theory with like back reactions and things, it should be completely obvious that the Kodama state is fine to zero order. The perturbed Kodama state is a complete nonsense, okay? And for the following reason. So it's the same kind of Russian doll trick. How do things actually tie in? This is my perturbative Hamiltonian, the thing which has gravitons, etc. It's the thing which is quadratic in linear variables, okay? If I take something which is cubic, like this, well, I can build this thing, so... In the full theory, this guy factors, but in this guy, it doesn't factor, because I can have zero order guys, first, zero, 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 and actually quadratic terms in first order in S. So the self-dual operator to linear order, when they're actually doing perturbation theory, does not factorize. It factorizes in the non-perturbative theory. It does not factorize in the perturbative theory. And what this means is that obviously, the perturbed Kodama state is not even an eigenstate of the perturbative Hamiltonian. This is to be expected because what this thing represents is self-dual perturbations. And I told you this was known since 1987. What these self-dual perturbations are the right positive frequency of the graviton and the left negative frequency of the antigraviton. It's a bit like a Cooper pair of half particles, which don't really exist. I mean, the Kodama state is nonsense for this reason, and it should be obvious from the first place, even without identifying the inner product in connection space, which we have, or our functions in connection space, which we have.
That means you've picked some vacuum state, right?
No, I just expanded. I just did an expansion.
No, I know, but you could do a million expansions.
Yeah.
And then you can have a million different positive frequency choices. So which is the choice?
Well, that's a different issue. In this case, no, it's not. In this case, this is just a classical theory. So in the direction k, the positive frequency is e to the minus omega.
So it's basically the thing which propagates in the k direction. And the negative frequency is the complex conjugate of that. That's just a classical statement. And then basically your identity. So classically, you just solve the torsion-free conditions and you find these. Okay? You find that if you have like a wave, a classical wave, you work out the self-dual connection for this classical wave, and you find that the positive frequency of this thing is right graviton, the negative frequency is the left graviton. Okay, so basically, the fluctuations are this combination of half particles which don't make any sense. They're not gravitons, you need this from here. And obviously, they're not a physical state. So if you actually go through the calculation, we haven't published it yet, in terms of identifying, doing the thing not in the Bargmann representation, but in the connection representation, you obviously find this is not physical, not normalizable for me. So this is an important lesson, because the Kodama state, of course, was highly regarded for a good reason. So the Chern-Simons term is actually the Hamilton-Jacobi function, so this is like a semi-classical solution. Okay? And now you're saying this doesn't make any sense. So I think there's one lesson to learn from here, which is the path to phenomenology is never going to the semi-classical theory, contrary to what people have been trying to do. The phenomenology in this case is gravitons, and these may be perturbative, but they're never semi-classical, they're always fully quantum. And trying to do, so these crazy things which are semi-classical really are complete nonsense. And the Kodama state is obviously not a physical thing. Now the million-dollar question, before I move to the second 5 minutes, okay, is, okay, with the help of cosmology, we have found this alternative perturbative ground state. It's not the Kodama state. But the question is, what is it non-perturbatively? Is there, so the conjecture here is that there is a state, non-perturbative state, of which what we identified is the perturbative expression. And one of the big issues in quantum gravity has been to find what is actually the ground state along which to expand. So the conjecture here is that this is actually a better bet than the Kodama state or anything else. Okay, so this is like the first part of my digression. On a more pedestrian level, I said cosmologists wake up again, okay? So this is the other side of the implications of what I said. No self-respecting talking cosmology could do without a picture of the Planck satellite. As you know, we're all waiting with bated breath to see what the results are. They all look very tense. We have a Planck team in Imperial College. I don't think life is going very well. So this is actually the paper which we wrote a while ago, in which we had this model in which there was like a funny asymmetry between right and left graviton. So in any case, whenever you have a chiral background of gravity wave, something really funny happens. You have TB polarization. Let me tell you a bit about this, and then I'll promise I'll finish. So as you may know, we're all fed up with seeing the temperature maps, but we're going to be getting polarization maps very, very soon. There's two types of polarization, electric and magnetic. Don't confuse these with Yang-Mills electric magnetics. It's just one way of decomposing the polarization. And the reason, so the E polarization has been detected. B polarization is really interesting because it can only be produced, with one exception, by gravity waves. So if you measure B mode polarization, more or less directly you have measured, and with one proviso, you have actually measured gravity waves. Now, whenever you've shown these CLs, these C sub Ls, which is like, you know, what everyone shows in talks, in cosmology, is actually what these things are basically Legendre transforms of two-point functions. So there's basically like a superscript here. There's a subscript L, but you can consider the superscript, which is the pair you've taken in your two-point function. And what people initially showed was the C sub L TT. Okay, so you can consider these other pairs, and this is what is usually considered is TT, TE, EE, BB. It turns out that the B is the only one which is odd on a parity. The other ones are even. So the reason why these combinations are not considered usually is that they are odd ones. All these guys are even, but this is odd, TB and EB. And therefore, they are zero in any theory, which is parity invariant. Now, it turns out that, and this is the cool thing, is your plot. Actually, you can't see it very well. This is your C sub L plot for theories in which there is even a moderate amount of chirality. I'll quantify this in the next slide. What you actually find is that, okay, BB is actually much smaller than TB and DB, even with reasonable amounts of, or reasonable values of the Mirzi parameter that I qualify. And this is very easy to understand. When you do a BB, what BB is small times small, quadratic and small is very small. TB is basically big and small, so it's much bigger. So this is the reason why E-mode polarization was first detected by WMAP via TE, not via EE. because E is small, E is very small, T was bigger, so it was...
Those two are zero in a standard case, but BP is not zero.
Yeah. Okay. So this is a theory with a reasonable value of quantified of chirality, and you find this property that typically, without having something very extreme for the energy parameter, the TB is much bigger than the BB. For the same reason that the TE is much bigger than BE.
Yeah.
So this is a great, I mean, basically this
could be killing two pigeons with one stone. Of course, if there are no gravity waves, you won't test their chirality in this way. Of course, if there's no chirality, TB is zero, and this doesn't help. But if there are gravity waves, and if there is chirality, the best way to detect the gravity waves is via the chirality. And you can quantify this. You can prove the TB is bigger than BB for an Emirzi parameter in this range. In other words, you need to have something quite extreme for the TB to be smaller than BB. Okay, so this is quite a dramatic result. And let me just conclude. So as I showed, this was quite technical in the middle, but I think it was obvious you could, after sweating a lot and getting some technical results right and everything, it is possible to recover cosmological perturbation theory within the Ashtaker formalism. The exercise suggests a different ground state, which is chiral. So the quantum gravity quantization does correct the usual inflationary calculation, and the implication is observationally quite striking. And the way, this was actually reported by New Scientist in a very political way, which is gravity's bias for left, maybe read in the sky, something to do with men versus women and everything. So maybe I'll stop here. Thank you.
So, maybe you can come up with a toy model that does this, because in quantum mechanics, if you have two harmonic oscillators, which are classically the same, quantum mechanically the same, unless you add interactions, I mean, at the quadratic level.
So I've been trying to come up with a toy model, and this means having something like an harmonic oscillator representing the metric and another one representing the connection.
But I was thinking more like my left-handed and right-handed being two different harmonic oscillators.
It's different, but actually, it is not. It's actually quite difficult to represent a system like this. I've been trying to find a toy model, because it would be, for cosmosis, it would be much, people like
yeah.
It would be much easier. But,
because, I mean, otherwise you worry that maybe there is some technicality there that obviously I cannot follow, but maybe that's the right.
Yeah.
So that's why this the toy model would really help. This is something you've never seen in quantum mechanics. As I said, the two harmonic oscillators that are not the same, that are exactly identical classically, but are not identical.
But it's a funny theory. I mean, Young-Hills theories are very, for example, Maxwell theory. It leads to the harmonic oscillator very, very straightforward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Whereas this Hamiltonian constraint is really completely crazy. The Hamiltonian of gravity. So this formula makes gravity look like a gauge theory, but the Hamiltonian constraint is unique. It's completely different.
But it's
so when you try to represent it like a quadratic thing,
but we're talking about,
you expect funny things, right, to appear.
We are talking about quadratic Hamiltonian,
right? Well, you are talking about obtaining a quadratic perturbation out of an Hamiltonian, which is quite complicated.
Sure, but
so it would be nice to have some kind of time model which explain really what is happening. But, but don't be surprised that it's something different from the photon.
Sure, and that's fine.
Yeah. But this is actually, so the problem is that you do have twice the number of modes, because it's like having an X which is complex.
Mm-hmm.
And then only later on you make it real with some kind of conditional linear product. So it's kind of...
Yeah, so maybe...
And this is the problem, it's a constraint system which turns out to be real. It's actually a second class constraint. So this is very difficult to actually visualize it the way you're trying to do it.
Yeah.
But I'll do my best,
It certainly would be very helpful, because all the non-trivial things you know happens when you include interactions.
No, but this is about having constraints which are second-class constraints. That's the problem. The way you remove the anti-gravity, these extra degrees of freedom, is exactly the second-class constraint.
But second-class constraints, you could just essentially, at the quadratic level, you can just solve for them and forget about them.
No, it's something really funny. If you want to do it like that, I can't solve this, is the problem. So doing that classically would be equivalent to go here and make everything the real theory without torsion. That's the Jackson-Lubbock formulation in the math, especially. So solving it classically and then in the end just basically quantizing it leads to a different theory than just quantizing it and then trying to implement these things at the quantum level.
Maybe can you show the equations which were the crux of the matter where you have these different computations?
Which includes D?
Which was the crux of the matter?
Includes what, sir?
The crux of the matter. Can you go back to the equations where...
Depends what you mean by the crux.
Well, just they said the one where you have a gamma imaginary and it's a... You conclude that V is
this?
No, V4. Where is it? Where you conclude that, no, after. Where you conclude that, you know, V squared expectation value is zero. The chirality.
This one?
Okay, yeah, so this one.
So this is an ordering issue as well.
So that's why he's confused. So it seems that everything comes from. Choosing an ordering, right? So, which usually, so maybe this is where.
But I think it goes back to this issue about what is the, what are physical modes, what are non-physical modes. Because initially, if you put the non-physical modes, there's no chirality. The point is that this qualified half of the modes, in a way, which is very chiral because of these definitions. And this really comes, this is the thing, it's actually quite difficult to represent. In a single model, capturing a single model, what is actually happening.
Yeah. But let's say if we go back to these equations here, I mean here before, like the one
before.
No, the one we just showed. Yeah, where was that? No, the expectation value. So the yeah. So. The first thing which is behind, if I understand properly, is that you said this rate of productions of modes, this V square, expectation value of V square. Okay. So essentially, it's some kind of expectation value of the number operator in the vacuum. So that's where, you know, and now, of course, the number operator in the vacuum depends on the choice of ordering because n plus 1 or n minus 1. So this is where it's kind of
so one
maybe
thing
disturbing because you're saying that the physical observable. You know, it depends on somehow these.
Yeah, but this is an ordering issue. One thing you could do is, for example, have a chiral order that would remove this completely. I mean, the idea
yes.
is that, yeah,
yes.
I would do it.
Yes.
So the assumption here is that you order things according to whatever principle you must have before you second quantize and you perturb. And of course, I cannot know about the chirality. Then you have to live with it.
So if the ordering descends from an ordering of the full non-perturbative theory, then the left-handed and right-handed parts end up ordered differently. Mm-hmm. That's the message. Mm-hmm.
But the second message is that disordering goes in usual physics, let's say, without gravity. The conclusion is that you know this. I mean, you can shift the Hamiltonian by any constant or any mode, and physics is totally insensitive to a choice of ordering.
But the ordering is very important.
Yeah, and usually, so that what you're saying here is that in fact this choice of ordering is an observable. And that's, I guess, where, I don't know, it's surprising, right? Because this is really the surprise of me. I agree, it was also my first reaction, because we're used, let's say, in non-gravitational physics, the choice of ordering is totally irrelevant because it's just a shift of reference point for the zero energy.
Right.
So here you're saying, well, in fact, the choice of reference points for zero energy does matter in gravity, and there, you know, there's a context where I can choose different reference points
for left
graviton and y graviton, and I have this gamma that measure this freedom.
So
and surprisingly, it creeps into a physical observable, and that's maybe why a shortcut argument would be very.
So one thing, so did this may actually help you guys. One thing you've done, which was very, so maybe I should have shown recent work in which you write these wave functions in connection space. But in your paper, you already noticed that the wave functions, so there's an issue about, obviously, about how to identify modes and so on. But you already have like a delta function for the right, and then an explanation for the left.
remember that. And what does it mean? So it actually survives. So this is, until you put inner product, this doesn't mean anything. But even with inner product, you basically can recover this result writing wave functions for the vacuum by integrating basically these, like the physical map, in connection representation. You basically do get things like this, on this form. So this might be easier. You're basically saying that you have a framework in which you have your box standard exponential for one of the modes, for the vacuum, but you have a delta function for the other. And this is just the way your formalism works, and it's kind of...
No.
It's not. It's the way, it's the fact that this guy is chirally, for the right guy, this guy is actually just a connection, whereas for the left one, is a relation between the connection and the metric. And of course, the metric is a derivative with respect to one of these guys.
Can I ask something very simple? If I wanted to do this, what I'm used to do for usual perturbation theory, that I have a mode function and I, in high frequency I know what how the mode function looks like, right? That, like Minkowski vacuum. Could I do that here to see how much it differs from left to left, from right? Or
but this is what we've done. So it's basically considering the k eta going to infinity. This is effectively what we've
done. Okay, so what's
the. But you see, the difference is here in this equation. So let's say in the usual case, you put. You know, if you look at the first line of the second thing, the G dagger is on the left.
But,
right?
So
in the usual case,
function,
the G dagger would be on the right.
Like?
What?
In terms of the mode function, how does it look like?
In terms of the mode function, it would look like the G dagger is on the right.
Yeah.
That's all. So you put the G dagger on the left.
This is, but this is the putting it on the right. Basically, this boils down to this. That's basically the way the G's are defined in terms of the area.
But it seems to me the moral of the story, I mean, I agree with what everybody is saying, what Richard is saying, but the moral of the story is that what's the advantage of the emergency parameter being pure imaginary? Like, what's the whole point of the Ashtekar variables? The whole point of the Ashtekar variables is that the general relativity is a nonlinear system, but any system can be made as least nonlinear as possible by adding auxiliary fields. And general relativity has the weird property that if you make it into a cubic form, where the action is cubic and the equations of motion are quadratic, okay, that enforces a kind of chirality. That is, the simplest form for the equations of motion of general relativity is the one which the one that Ashtekar uses, which corresponds to the emergency parameter.
It's maximally chiral.
It's maximally chiral, but it's the maximally simplest form of the Einstein equation.
Yes.
Okay. And that's the deep. That's also related to the deep thing that why Twister theory works and why Penrose chose a maximally chiral representation for Twister theory. Okay. And then the moral of the story is, if you quantize this nonlinear but least minimally nonlinear theory, choose an ordering of that, and then linearize around De Sitter space, you end up with this operator ordering which is not chirally symmetric, and therefore with the results that you end up with. So they're a consequence of taking seriously, for the quantum theory, the moral that you should, before you quantize, you should write the action in the simplest possible form. And then the choice looks less arbitrary. I mean, you can always undo this by at the last minute saying, your linearized theory, I'm going to choose a different ordering.
Yeah, sure, of course.
But then that ordering would not arise from the linearization of a nonlinear quantum theory.
That's right. So, for example, a funny thing, remember the Wheaton's paper? This whole thing was sparked, your paper was sparked by the Wheaton's paper, I guess, about the Kodama state in Young Mills.
I don't know that it was sparked by Witt's paper, but it was irritated by Witt's paper.
So in that case, it's different. Was Hamiltonian is just this guy? It's much simpler for this guy.
Yes.
Self-neural type stuff, that's self-neural. And even in the Kodama state, it's all about using photons.
Right.
And it's an ordering issue. And it's a very non-local ordering issue. But it's something which is local in Fourier space, once you perturb the theory and everything.
Right. Yes.
Basically, you can classically do this, right? By like any Maxwell theory, right?
Right, but that's no—that's not a simplification in the way that I was saying.
Exactly,
because this is still quite whatever order it was in originally. It's still the same order of equation. Whereas the Ashtar variables are a genuine simplification, that is, they're a reduction of the order of nonlinearity in the equation to quadratic equations. Every field equation in the Ashtar formulation is a quadratic equation, which is the simplest an equation can be without being linear.
So, of course, the price you have to pay for that is the complexifier. And now we have the reality formation. So, the complication, the nightmare that relativity is, comes back to haunt you later on in the form of the reality conditions. And they're very important here, of course.
Sure.
Any more questions? I'm not sure if Ben will speak again.